leaders have to start with self-reflection. And I keep coming back to that. If you don't understand yourself as a leader, and then the time to, and that's where we don't have the time to reflect a lot of the time. We've just all gotten so busy with a thousand emails, and I feel it. I miss when I was in the United States the last 4-5 years as president of a consulting firm. I was flying 120 flights a year, and that was my reflection time.
Welcome to the People Leaders Podcast, the audio resource for managers and business leaders creating high-performing teams. Join leadership and team development experts Jan and Michelle Turkelson each week as they explore both subjects from every angle. Through practical tips, valuable insights, and compelling interviews with leadership experts around the world, you'll learn how to bring out the best in your staff and how to give your best as a leader.
Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Jan.
I'm really excited for this podcast. We have a special guest, and we always love it when we have guests because we actually get to ask the questions and find out information. And we usually try to enter the conversation that our people leaders and our listeners are having inside their head. So I'd like to introduce you to Gretchen, who is an expert in the construction industry, and she has been consulting to some high-level clients over the years, such as Intel, Marriott, Hewlett-Packard, Procter Gamble, United Airlines, and the list goes on. Gretchen is also an affiliate professor at the Australian National University and University of Denver. And Gretchen develops and teaches courses on leadership, ethics, change, and agility. And Gretchen's research really explores the relationship between leader behaviors and organization agility, which is something that we're going to ask Gretchen about. There's more. Gretchen holds a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering, MBA from the University of Denver, Master's in Nonprofit Management, PhD in Org Performance, Learning and Change from Colorado State University. She also, her PhD studies in leadership and organization agility really inform her work with clients and her postgraduate teaching at the University of Denver. Now, Gretchen also has a passion for women's leadership, and she is very invested in women leaders, also a former president of the Women's Foundation of Colorado, female executive in the male-dominated industry of manufacturing, engineering, construction, which we know all about. And also, you've written a book, Gretchen, on the 8 steps to being a great working mother. And finally, to cap it all off, you've done a TED Talk.
Yes. I've been a little busy, but mostly that makes me feel like I'm old because I've done a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's right, yes. It's kind of like cramming 3 lifetimes into one.
Yes, and I'm so thrilled to be here in Australia. I've been here 9 months and I'm just loving it.
Wonderful. It sounds like you have a breadth of interest and experience, but now it seems that you are kind of really focused on leadership and women. And is that what you would say your main focus is at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. My consulting firm, Greatness Consulting, we focus on great leaders, great teams, and great organizations. And how do you really, you know, the word greatness comes from Jim Collins way back when. Reading Good to Great and Built to Last. And I just really enjoy helping people solve strategic issues, whether that's individuals, teams, or thinking more broadly about how do you create an agile culture? How do you create change management as a capability? Because everything seems to be changing so much faster these days.
Without a doubt. That seems to be one of the core competencies that all leaders need for the 21st century is that change leadership, which brings me to this question around agility. How do you define agility, Gretchen?
Yeah, so there's lots of different frameworks out there for organization agility. I really like Linda Holbesch's, for example. I actually just did a podcast with her. She's in England. She has a book called The Agile Organization. But the one I used for my studies is from a book called The Agility Factor by Chris Worley Ed Lawler and Worley Williams and Lawler, two scholars and a consultant in the U.S. that studied over 400 organizations and looked at their financial performance in a 32-year period and really tried to define those organizations that achieved, that beat the median return on assets of their industry more than 80% of the time. And then they surmised that, you know, if they're going to be have that sustained performance, then they really have to be agile. They've got to be changing their products and services in reactions to shift in the business environment. And they defined four agile routines that they found in the 18% of the companies that achieved this. Agile strategizing, agile perceiving, agile testing, and agile implementation.
Correct.
Yeah, so they actually developed an instrument to measure the presence of these four routines. So for my PhD study, I looked at 47 corporations, 126 business units, and I measured the behaviors of the leader of that business unit and the presence of these agile routines to see if there was a statistical relationship, and there was. And hopefully that first article is going to be published here anytime soon in a peer-reviewed journal on that research.
Oh, great. I'll be really interested to read that. About the relationship between leader behaviors and organizational agility, could you give us some ideas on what behaviors we would see leaders expressing doing if they were demonstrating that type of agility?
Yeah, it's interesting because I used a well-established instrument called the MLQ, the Multi-Factor Leader Questionnaire. And there were some things that I kind of expected, like my leader gets me to think about doing things in new ways and approaching problems from different perspectives. But some of the leader behaviors were almost related, correlated to kind of a laissez-faire type of leadership, like not around until something blows up, you know, very hands-off, which when you think about it retrospectively, that would make sense. You're challenging your people to think about things differently, but you can't be there to micromanage everything for them or they won't succeed.
Oh, absolutely. And we just had a conversation with a client this morning, and he was trying to convey that to his leadership team is that you need to trust your people and get out of the way. You need to support them, but let them make that impact. And you know they're competent enough, so let them do it.
Yes, absolutely. And the one thing that I would have loved to have also researched, and I plan to in the future, is how culture kind of envelops this whole thing. I've had the good fortune to get to know Ed Schein over the past 4 years, and Edgar Schein is just such a noted thinker on culture. And what does a leader do to create a culture where these four agile routines thrive?
Yes.
That's another thing I'm really interested in.
Yes.
So Jan, you go.
No, you go. I know what you're
going to
say.
I know. So again, we totally believe in the link between leadership and the impact that it has on culture, and we feel that it's one of the key levers for creating change in an organisation. And for us, sometimes it's difficult for the leader to actually see how strong the impact is that they are having on the culture. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, oh, all the issues are out there. It's resources, it's other people, it's stakeholders, it's the organization. How do you get leaders to actually see that they, play such a significant role in creating the environment that, you know, creates a constructive culture?
Yeah, I think you first have to get them to really understand what their culture is. You know, when Ed Schein talks about artifacts as one aspect of culture, I had 25 leaders in an engineering group go out and take pictures that they thought reflected their culture in their corporate headquarters. Mm-hmm. And then we did a slideshow of those pictures and said, what words, you know, why did you take this picture and captured those words and then said, great, what words do we want to keep and what words do we want to jettison? But also going to Edgar Schein, the third aspect of culture is the shared beliefs that happen through actions, and really trying to get leaders to understand it's not just the espoused values. It's not just what you say. every action that you take, every question that you ask, it reinforces a culture, whether you want it to or not, good or bad. And it's not just what you say; it is what you do on a daily basis, which is a lot of pressure, I guess, as a leader, to understand that all eyes are upon you.
Mm, that's right. And to that, you know, like just going on from that train of thought, it is what you think and what you do, but also, you know, like how you emote that and the words that you use, how you craft an email, you know, like everything is a representation of who you are. Mm-hmm. And to develop a level of awareness or self-awareness in a leader would be one of the first places that we usually start from as well. Which leads me to the question, Gretchen, I'd be interested for your opinion around the difference between leaders and teams in the United States and what you've actually experienced in Australia.
It's really interesting that you asked that question. Plus, I just finished teaching delivering team results at ANU to 38 postgrads that came from multiple countries, China, India, Cambodia. So I'm really getting a lot of exposure to different places in the world. I do think that not just even the country, but Ed Schein recommended a book to me in the U.S. called 11 Nations. And mm-hmm. it's about the 11 different cultures of North America. So having moved around the United States quite a bit, I've lived in Kansas, Texas, New York. You know, there really are regional cultures even within the United States. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to do some work with a team in Western Australia. I just took my first trip to Perth last week, which very much reminds me of Denver, my hometown for the last 27 years. Except Perth has a beach too. Yeah. Makes it much better. Not quite the mountains for skiing, but but I think even there's so many similarities and yet nuances. And one of the team members happens to be from a European country and said, you know, because I'm from this country, this is how we feel about trust. And we're just becoming this big, you know, hodgepodge of people. It's literally a, you know, like a German, two Brits, an Australian, and a whatever thrown together on a team. So I think we have to be really cognizant of how our backgrounds and our nationalities impact our ability to lead and our ability to perform effectively on teams.
Mm. And the whole focus on diversity and inclusion in the workplace. You know, we want diversity, and with diversity comes a whole range of different ways of being and thinking. And it's not just gender and culture. There are so many other aspects to it as well that you see. So have you seen any difference at all, or is it just one of those things that, you know, like there's no such thing as a typical Australian?
Yeah. You know, I'm in my infancy. I couldn't work the first 90 days I was here. So I've only been working with teams for less than 6 months. Mm. And interestingly, all the teams that I'm working with are multicultural. So that's been, as I said, part of the interesting challenge for me. I think that the people that I've interacted with here, I'm trying to think of like Kristen Hansen, who wrote the book Traction, and Gabriel Dolan, who has her new book out, Real Communication, and all her great billboards all over Melbourne and Sydney. When I have interactions with other experts, it seems like it's a very similar client. Mm. And if you take a book like The Five Dysfunctions of a Team or other books, I wouldn't in any way say, wow, I don't see that happening. In fact, I was teaching Tuckman's Forming, Storming, Norming, and Performing, which I use a lot because I'm pulled in when people are storming most of the time and really trying to get them to create some norms. So those norms might be culturally impacted, but I think the framework still works.
Isn't that interesting? After all these years, and we work with a lot of different coaches, and that is one of their go-to tools when they're working with teams.
Yeah,
you know, just to assess where they're at. And so I suppose if it's not broken, why reinvent a new one?
Yes.
And there's always another framework that you can overlay on a team, because sometimes it might be levels of performance. So we have a look at teams that might be in either dysfunction or challenged, and then moving through to coping, managing, and then high performance. Mm-hmm. And they have certain characteristics that we see. We're working with a couple of teams at the moment that are in the challenged space, and then some on the other in, end is the high performance. And it's really interesting to see the similarities of the dysfunctional teams and the similarities of the high performance. Yeah. And everyone on a high performing team says that it's so much fun to be on a high performing team, and that they enjoy it. So yeah, it's worth the effort.
Yeah, I don't know if you all use the Google Aristotle project over here. We just started using a couple of years ago extensively in the U.S. and really just trying to unpeel psychological safety. I'm an, you know, I'm a mechanical engineer. I consult mostly in engineering and construction. And so having been through engineering school, nothing in engineering school prepared for how to create psychological safety. I mean, I came out and went directly into running manufacturing plants and kind of had to learn by the seat of my pants as a leader what worked and what didn't. But I think the great part is we're starting to have more conversations, and we're bringing the neuroscience into it, like Kristen Hansen's book Traction, and really understanding amygdala hijacks. Who was talking about amygdalas 10 years ago, right? Nobody.
Absolutely. And it's funny because Jan and I recorded a podcast on psychological safety, and one of and a thing that is downloaded from our website all the time is the SCARF model by David Rock. And so yes, it is just becoming part of the, you know, leadership lexicon. And in terms of that psychological safety, I was listening to something this morning about psychological safety, and I really loved the way that they framed it was, you know, it's a place where you feel that you can be who you really are, and it's okay. And I thought, oh, that's a nice sort of pared down approach, because sometimes when you use the word psychological safety with teams that don't use that phraseology all the time, it can feel a little bit sort of convoluted for them.
Yeah, it can make them feel insecure, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to reveal my deepest, darkest secret. That's, that's not what this is about. It's about not having to show up in your, you know, in your biggest form, in your puffed out form, but being able to say, hey, I don't know that, or I don't understand that.
And it's okay.
So you just answered the next question, Gretchen. I was going to ask, you know, what tips would you give to either leaders or teams to demonstrate or to develop psychological safety?
I think one of the first is that you have to be able to reveal of yourself. And I use things like the DISC profile, and everybody, and I describe myself as kind of a Labrador that just comes up and slobbers all over everybody, you know, for my personality. So this is not a problem for me, but being able to say, hey, this is what I'm good at. And this, I really stink at this. I mean, I'm a low C. And so finishing a 172-page dissertation was really challenging for me. And I had to get Team Gretchen involved in this, right? So I think a leader starting with their own humility and their own comfort of being able to say, here's the value that I think I bring to the team. Here's things I'm not good at, because great leaders surround themselves with people that fill in those gaps, right? You know, when I hire an assistant, she has to have high detail because it's a disaster if neither one of us has an orientation to detail. So I think that's one of the first good steps.
Yeah, I spot on, Gretchen. And what we usually offer for team leaders is in their team meeting start, because some people actually want to change something within their team, but they actually don't provide the context. And sometimes it's just a matter of the leader saying, I've been reflecting deeply about how the team is operating, and I'm feeling that we can do better. And this is where I'm struggling, and this is where I'd like support. And what do you think about that? You know, just have those words.
I agree 100%. And the other thing that I think, you know, I've been president of two companies. I've been an assistant dean. You know, at 27, I was running a $28 million operating budget with 800 union employees and a failing company that we ended up turning around. And I think one of the misconceptions is that you're soft, right? And so recently, and I literally fired 30 year employees in that turnaround because they couldn't make the leap to self-directed work teams. And I was recently, not probably a year ago, meeting with a CEO of a very large company, 10,000 employees, and who had been working on a cultural change for 3 years and was frustrated that it hadn't he hadn't made progress. And I said, who have you fired? And he looked at me really strangely, and I'm like, well, somebody hasn't gotten in the boat, if your culture is not changing, then people aren't getting in the boat. Sometimes you have to fire one across the bow and you have to take somebody, sometimes very senior. And sometimes when you, even when you approach them like that, you can turn them into one of your biggest advocates, but you have to be firm as a leader. And that, and it doesn't mean you're soft. And if you have naysayers that are dragging down the team, you have to address that. I think that's another misconception.
Totally. Yeah, Jan and I, you know, talk about this, having the courage to be honest about people's performance. Mm-hmm. And we find that no matter what level of the organization, it is really challenging for a lot of people to move people on. Yeah. And it's something that a lot of client or a lot of managers in Australia really struggle with.
Well, it's a skill set. It's not a people thing, right?
That's usually right.
A square peg in a round hole. So if you can sit down and have that honest conversation with somebody, let's say I had this situation years and years ago, I had a CFO that was not, she was giving me reports that had errors in them. Over and over, and luckily I have a degree in finance, so I was catching those. But at some point, you have to say, "Look, your level of detail, and when you coach, and what can we do to help? What resources can we provide?" But at some point, sometimes you have to look people in the eye and say, "It's just not a good fit."
Yep, and that requires a bit of courage, doesn't it?
It does, definitely. Mm.
So, Gretchen, I've got a couple of questions around your lecturing, because Michelle's also lecturing at the moment at Deakin on change. Is that right, Michelle?
Yeah, change management.
Yes. Yeah, so, Gretchen, I've just got a question on some of the topics that you lecture on, and perhaps you could share some of you, your insights as to what leaders and team members need to know in this changing environment.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I just taught two courses, evidence-based management and delivering team performance. And then next semester, I'm teaching leading people in change and thought leadership in organizations. And I had Christine Seitz, who is the CEO of Leidos Australia, as a guest speaker. And she talked about leaders have to start with self-reflection. And I keep coming back to that. If you don't understand yourself as a leader, and then and that's where we don't have the time to reflect a lot of the time. We've just all gotten so busy with a thousand emails, and I feel it. I miss when I was in the United States the last 4-5 years as president of a consulting firm. I was flying 120 flights a year, and that was my reflection time. I didn't Wi-Fi, I journal, you know, goal setting, etc. So the pressures of this crazy vortex world that we're in and not having that time to reflect on who am I, what am I working on? Back to Stephen Covey, sharpen the saw, right? What am I trying to get better? And because then you have to role model that for your team, right? Yeah. Because that's what you want your team to be doing. And you have to get, I'm using Edgar and Peter Schein's new book, Humble Leadership, in my US course. I teach on leadership and ethics at the University of Denver. And they talk about level two relationships and how you build those. Well, once again, that takes time. It's just not, I don't have a magic wand that you just wave and, oh my gosh, we have a level two relationship, right? you have to talk. And if you're going to create shared mental models, that happens through language and spending time together. So
that's right. And sharing how you actually think and arrive at conclusions and decisions. Mm-hmm. And that takes a little, like you said, level of self-awareness.
Yeah, definitely. And I just, you know, email seemed like a great thing, and it is a great thing, but how we carve that time out to understand ourselves and our team. The other thing I learned, and I loved teaching evidence-based management. I had 115 students in that course. Having just gotten my PhD, I started it at 50. I was 50 years old when I started my PhD. So I had all these years of practitioner experience and 3 degrees, you know, engineering, finance, and I have a master's in nonprofit. But I really wanted to understand with rigor the research over the last 50 years in change and culture and leadership. And I went all the way back to Burns and leadership and Lewin and change. And it gave me they just beat claim evidence into us so that when people make claims about things, what's their evidence to support that? And I'm frustrated that there's not more connection between business and scholarly research because, you know, the journals kind of lock this stuff away. If you don't have a student access to journals, then you have to pay for articles, except for things like ResearchGate, which are free. And so bringing more of the research and the practice together and intertwining that so that we're putting the research into action and learning through that, not just the rigor of scholarly research.
Oh, look, I couldn't agree more. When you can bring to life some of these theories based on what people can see around them, their own experiences, whether they're working in a, you know, their students working in a shop or a retail section, or whether they're people who have been in the workforce for a long time, it's so important to bridge that gap because through examples and case studies, and that sounds like a very interesting course. We'll have to talk further about that.
Yeah, there's actually the Center for Evidence-Based Management, which is based in Europe somewhere, I believe. I've scheduled a podcast with one of their founders, and it's really just kind of sparked this drive that they have for managers accessing and leaders accessing evidence for the decisions that they're making on a daily basis. Really interesting. That's one of the reasons I love to teach is because I'm always learning too.
Learning, yeah.
And there's something about having some type of either research or context to give you a little bit more, push to do something that you haven't done before, because if you know what the benefits, someone's already done it before, they've put some really considered thinking behind it, more than likely you can actually convince yourself first that it's worth doing. So Gretchen, can you just share with us what you're currently working on?
Oh my gosh. Well, so teaching, I'm headed to Africa on Saturday. I'm becoming chair of the board of Bridges to Prosperity. We enable communities to build footbridges around the world. We just entered into an agreement with Rwanda to build 350 bridges in 5 years. So we're contributing $12 million. We're raising $14 million. So that's, I just actually joined the board here in Australia of Fabian Dattner's nonprofit that she started, Homeward Bound, which teaches female scientists advocacy, leadership skills. So it's kind of taking my STEM background and my women's leadership. I'm kicking off a women's leadership program in the energy industry this week. It's a brand new course that's kind of designed around some work that the American Gas Association was doing in the United States, because we need more of a pipeline of women in engineering and construction and energy and infrastructure. Doing a little consulting and continuing to teach and trying to carve out a little more time for research and enjoying Australia. So I'm a very avid golfer. I golf every weekend. So just played two wonderful courses over by Perth. It was quite windy that day, made it very interesting, but my husband and I really enjoy getting out and golfing, and the 10,000 beaches in Australia. I have to say, I've definitely been taking advantage of those.
Right. So it seems like you're a little bit of a high performer here, and that takes a bit of energy. So do you want to share with us three habits that you put in place to set yourself up in the best possible shape? So something that you might do mentally, emotionally, and physically.
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with a heart arrhythmia 12 years ago, and it was completely stress-related. So I've spent a lot of time on this. I have not had any caffeine in 12 years. So I try and eat right. Although I did tell my cardiologist, if he took my wine away, there'd be serious repercussions for that. I work out. I try to work out 4 to 5 times a week. I've been doing Orange Theory in the United States. I still do that in Melbourne and Sydney. I have a different gym that I use. So really being, it's a very sacred, that time for working out. It's one of my because I tell people, as a leader, you have to show up like an athlete. And I sleep 8 hours every night. So sleep and exercise and eating right and not having caffeine and that golf thing. It's one of my big stress relievers too, going out and whacking a little white ball on a golf course and not taking it seriously. That's the key. You can't take it seriously or it's not a stress reliever anymore.
So. Right. Okay. So I've got one last question, and the question's got to do with, out of all the advice that you give your clients, what's that piece of advice that you give that you actually need to listen to yourself about?
Oh, gosh. Probably not putting too much on my plate. Knowing how to say no. As you indicated, I have a book and a TED Talk about being a working mom. I flew every week until my kids were 7 and 8 years old. And people said a lot of things to me about how my kids were going to turn out based upon having a working mom. But I did. That was the beginning when they were born of me starting to learn how to say no. Mm-hmm. I have to reacclimate myself to that sometimes. But yeah, it's easier for me to tell other people to do that than it is for me to do it myself. It's definitely something I'm still working on.
Yeah, same.
So, Michelle, have you got another last question for Gretchen?
I think Gretchen's done a great job. I mean, I've got so many questions that could lead us down tangents, and I just hope that Gretchen is open to coming back again and exploring some of the topics that she raised. Does that sound okay for you, Gretchen?
Oh, yes, I would love to. I could.
Yeah.
We could all talk about this. Speaking of a glass of wine, I think the three of us need to go have one at some point and spend hours talking about these topics.
Yes, you don't have to twist my arm for that.
Yeah.
Well, Gretchen, thank you so much for putting in the time to have a conversation with us. To wrap up, the takeaway that I got from our conversation is that for leaders, you know, to start from any place, it really is they need time to reflect, because that's the start of developing a level of awareness. And the other thing that I really love that you said is that leaders have to show up like an athlete. That's been my takeaway. Michelle, what's been your takeaway?
You always steal my thunder, Jan. That was totally, in terms of reflection for me, it's one of the things that I would always, and we always do encourage our coaching clients to do, is to carve some of that time out at the end of the day or the week with a few key questions on self-reflection, because that creates the space to change. If you don't do that, you just get busier and busier and busier, and then you're like this rat on the wheel. And the other thing that I took away is that, yes, sometimes you have to let people go. You have to fire people and make a stand for your organisation. And it's not a pleasant thing to do, but it's the right thing to do. Totally agree.
So, Gretchen, need to know you're serious.
That's right. So, Gretchen, if people want to learn more about you or connect with you, what would you get them to do?
Well, it's Gretchen Gagel, like a bagel, only with a G, and LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn. And then my website is greatnessconsulting.com. Perfect. And it has some blurbs about my work and some quotes from some of my clients.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you so much, Gretchen. It's been wonderful to have this conversation with you.
We've learned a lot. And let's keep talking.
Definitely. Really appreciated it. Thank you so much.
Okay, ciao.
Ciao.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the People Leaders Podcast. For show notes and other resources, please visit us at peopleleaderspodcast.com. While you're there, you can subscribe for future episodes so you can continue your own leadership journey. And please be sure to share this and other episodes with your friends and colleagues. The People Leaders Podcast is brought to you by the Experts On Air Podcast Network.